This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. As transition is afoot in Washington, so too in Concord, where Governor-elect Chris Sununu is picking his transition team and spelling out priorities. New Hampshire joins 41 other states in a lawsuit against the maker of the opioid treatment drug Suboxone. And Statehouse Republicans prepare to pick their leader, and unlike 2 years ago, this time everyone agrees to support the caucus pick for Speaker. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. Join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joining us this week, our transmitter of the New Hampshire Union Leader, Ella Nilsson, Concord Monitor, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Good morning, all. Let's start with Governor-elect Chris Sununu. If you've been listening to NHPR this morning, you've heard chunks of an interview he did with Morning Edition host Rick Ganley. It'll be 6 weeks before Chris Sununu is governor, but he wasn't shy about tipping his hand on some big issues. He hopes to include some fresh tax cuts in his budget, for instance. Why don't we listen to that? This is Chris Sununu on tax cuts.
By cutting the rates, you can entice more business to come across the borders, which again can increase your tax base. See, by breaking down regulation and by lowering taxes, you can actually increase your tax base because you're creating a state that says we're open for business. You start becoming competitive to states like Massachusetts or even like Maine and even Vermont now. I mean, they've been very competitive with business.
All right. Look out, Maine and Vermont. That was Governor-elect Chris Sununu talking business taxes this morning on Morning Edition. Obviously, restoring the New Hampshire advantage is something that he talked about a great deal during his campaign. This is something that you might expect from a Republican governor with all Republicans in the House. Tax cuts are something that seemed quite plausible, don't they, Trent?
Oh, absolutely. I think that Republicans, from what I've heard, Republicans are planning to push through a number of their major agenda items very quickly. Republicans have not had someone in the corner office for more than a decade, and they're actually, I think the word that I've heard is giddy about all of the stuff that they're going to be able to get done. Not just business tax cuts, but constitutional carry, changes to the education funding system, all kinds of items that they used to have to really negotiate pretty hard to get past a Democratic governor. They are now ready to rock, and they're already getting ready to get a lot of this legislation in so that they don't have to waste any time.
Or not get past a Democratic governor. And obviously the business taxes were a flashpoint during the last budget, and certainly we've heard a great deal about them on the campaign trail. And, you know, they prompted cuts to business enterprise and business profits tax, prompted Governor Hassan to veto one budget plan. She obviously ultimately signed another that actually accelerated those cuts but included provisions she said were safeguards. You know, she was worried about budget holes, and right now, given the revenues, those seem unfounded. But did the business tax cuts boost revenue? Was it a freshening economy? Those are murky questions. Dean, do you think that, as Trent says, it's going to be giddy, or do you think people are going to be let's take our time here?
Well, there's always a little bit of initial giddiness, especially when there's this kind of pent-up demand for legislation among Republicans. I think it's going to be an adjustment for Democrats having a Republican in the governor's office for the first time in over a decade. I think Democrats had gotten comfortable with the idea that they would see things pop up in the legislature that would pass the legislature, but they always knew they had the backstop of a Democratic governor, whether it was John Lynch or Maggie Hassan. That's going to change now. The clip we heard from Chris Sununu, sort of fairly traditional Republican economic dogma. I think the Democrats will try to balance that out and talk about, tax cuts, potentially sacrificing revenue for important programs for the state's citizens. That said, Democrats and we've all heard them. I'm sorry, Republicans. We've all heard them point to, the revenue that's come in since the whole budget issue with the tax cuts and the veto. As you said, there's always debate over what actually produces the additional revenue. But I think, you know, Sununu has been fairly clear that that he's going to focus on the tax side of things. And we've heard from Republican business leaders over the years that they feel that the business environment needs to be more competitive, even though we have a very low unemployment rate. And so I think he's going to move it in that direction if he can.
And so other than, you know, Trent mentioned a host of issues, you know, Ella, what have you been hearing about issues, you know, dear to Republicans that may be getting a fresh hearing with Republicans now in control of everything in Congress?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that a lot of what Trent said, you know, certainly some gun legislation. I think obviously the heroin and opioid crisis is going to continue to be a huge priority for both Democrats and Republicans in the state. That's probably something that they will be able to agree on. We might see some differences as far as, you know, how much money gets put towards treatment and prevention and how much goes towards law enforcement. It was interesting to me to see that Chris Sununu actually kind of has is proposing some kind of new things that will require revenue stream. He supports funding full day kindergarten. He has talked about replenishing the state's school building aid, which has fallen off, and has sort of talked about sort of the dilapidated condition of some of the state schools, and said that we need to fix that. So it seems like he does have some spending priorities, and so far as I know, he's pledged to not increase any taxes and fees, and has relied, as you said, on saying that business tax cuts will generate more revenue in the state. I guess it remains to be seen if that is going to be the only thing.
Well, one thing that is a revenue issue that certainly caught my ear as I was listening to the interview this morning was Chris Sununu's, who obviously a question of abortion rights and Planned Parenthood funding in particular were something that were big on the campaign trail. But he talked about a willingness to revisit some standards surrounding reproductive rights and abortion. Why don't we listen to what he had to say about that this morning?
I think a lot of the rules that are in place for existing facilities can simply be translated over and making sure that they are applicable to all facilities. And if those rules need to be adjusted a little bit, that's fine. I'm willing to look at that. But again, the rules need to be adjusted for everybody. It's about fairness and safety for women's health care.
All right. That was Chris Sununu this morning on Morning Edition. And Dean, he was talking about something that he referred to as a Women's Health Protection Act. And, you know, I remain a bit murky on exactly what he's envisioning there. But it was something to create standards for healthcare facilities that, you know, perform abortions, that may do ambulatory surgery, that may do any number of things. It wasn't entirely clear, but this issue has been something that has been pushed by abortion opponents as a way to limit options.
Right. The argument is if you set the standards high enough, it's going to be very difficult for most providers to meet them, and it's a way of effectively reducing the options for women. You know, I heard this portion of the interview earlier this morning, and, you know, he really is trying to walk a bit of a tightrope on this issue, not wanting to be seen as kind of against, you know, women's health issues, but also trying to sort of delineate a very kind of specific set of issues around Planned Parenthood and their role in providing health services to women and in the state. We'll see how it kind of develops over time and what kind of pressures he is subject to from Republicans in the state legislature. But I agree, at this point, it's not exactly clear what this reproductive rights legislation might look like or regulations. And, you know, Planned Parenthood and other opponents of his on these kinds of issues have in other contexts around the country push back against these types of standards because they view them as kind of a backdoor way to sort of reduce access to the care.
And the fallout from the election, obviously, Planned Parenthood and other abortion rights groups were very supportive of his opponent, Democrat Colin Van Ostrand. You know, now Chris Sununu, you know, says and said this morning, you know, I support abortion rights for women. I am pro-choice. That is not going to change. He did say that, you know, he was open-minded about sort of considering or not considering future state contracts with Planned Parenthood. But, Ella, I'm assuming that, you know, he's going to be under a lot of scrutiny from, you know, abortion rights advocates who, you know, obviously since we've had Democrats in the office for a long time have really had the corner office as a backstop against things that would seek to erode you know, reproductive rights in New Hampshire.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I think that scrutiny started kind of actually right before the election happened. I think that week the Democrats sent out a statement because Sununu had sent an email out to his supporters detailing, you know, saying, I've always opposed taxpayer funding of abortions and I support our important family values platform initiatives, including, like you said, the Women's Health Protection Act, a fetal homicide bill, a late term abortion ban, and a New Hampshire buffer zone repeal. Those were some of the things. And, you know, Democrats immediately seized on that, saying, well, Sununu's always said that he's pro-life, but here, look at these things that he would be doing that would really restrict women's access to health and abortions in the state. You know, I think, like you said, I think he, you know, some of his positions on this are kind of murky. The Health Protection Act, he said he wants to make sure that everybody is held to the same standards, whether you are sort of a smaller clinic or a hospital. He wants to take a look at that. I also asked him about the fetal homicide bill when he was still running and still a candidate. And he sort of said that he wanted that as a protection in case a pregnant woman was, you know, was hurt by her spouse or killed, that he would want to have that measure in place if she, you know, for her baby as well, to have protections for the baby rather than a woman sort of being held to account for an abortion.
Mm. Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or exchange, NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. We have an email from Stacy in Concord. She says, Chris Sununu talks about cutting business taxes to grow the tax base and to bring in more businesses / jobs with the lowest unemployment rate. Who are going to fill these jobs? And, you know, that's a good question, Stacy. That's a problem that businesses are grappling with already, aren't they, Trent?
That's right. And under the Sununu administration, there is no way that a train is coming to Manchester, Concord, Nashua, or really anywhere else. That is going to be a big challenge, I think, for the Sununu administration, is trying to figure out how to get young people to stay in New Hampshire, how to fill these jobs, because businesses – I think that was one of the things we heard during the campaign was we heard from a lot of business leaders who said, I cannot fill jobs in Manchester, in Concord, in Nashua, and that they're competing really nationally for top talent and they can't compete. So that's going to be a big challenge for them. I think that the business tax cuts are sort of one part of the picture, but the other, you know, there are a lot of other parts of the picture, including how you attract talent to New Hampshire.
All right, we've got another email in from Dennis from Barrington. He says, shouldn't Republicans giddy to slash business and other taxes consider Kansas as a cautionary tale? Would businesses really want to move here if we have a subpar education system? New Hampshire graduates graduate with highest debt. Does this race to the bottom between states improve our national economy? That's Dennis from Barrington. And, you know, the question about, you know, if you cut taxes, will the money follow is one that tends to, you know, split on ideological lines. And, you know, I guess we'll see. One of the budget that is now in place set targets, revenue targets that had to be met for further tax cuts to go into place. Those will go into place, you know, as I understand it. But Chris Sununu is talking about taking further actions than what's already on the book. So I guess we will see where that goes. But, you know, to Trent's point, it is true that New Hampshire is both the sort of potentially the beneficiary and kind of the victim of Massachusetts' strong economy, and that some of the economic growth is spillover. But, you know, the jobs that we can't fill are being filled down there, aren't they, Dean?
That's, you know, very true. And we've seen, you know, a number of in the past, certainly Maggie Hassan had her whole innovation agenda, job retraining and giving people skills necessary to make them marketable. It's not only an issue of there not being enough of a labor pool for a lot of these jobs. I mean, there certainly are, you know, some sort of typical jobs that are available, but there's also more of a demand for skills and technology and things like that. And so it's not simply getting enough people into the state. It's getting people into the state who have the skills that employers want. And if not, figuring out ways to help them retrain so that they can be matched up with employers. So this is an ongoing issue. It has been, you know, New Hampshire's unemployment rate has been low for some time now. I think it's down to 2.8% now, which is pretty remarkable. The national rate is 4.9%. So significantly lower than the national average. So it's not simply getting people into the state, getting people in the state who have the appropriate training for these companies.
And so why don't we go to the phones? Mary's on the line from Warner. Good morning, Mary. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment about Sununu's. He's not fooling anybody. He's not fooling any woman in this state. Texas did this. Women do not need taking care of. We know our own bodies. We know what we the decisions we want to make for them. And Chris Sununu does not need to be making me safer. He does not need to do that. I don't need any man doing that. No woman in this state that wants to make choices for her own body and her own health care needs Chris Sununu to step in and say, oh, but your facilities aren't in up to par. And then he makes such stringent decisions so that they have to be closed, and then we have to travel to Massachusetts or something to get health care.
Well, so do you not believe him? We'll see where these policies go when he says he's pro-choice, as he describes himself.
No, I don't believe that that's what he's doing, because he's got the backing of a great deal of Republicans in this state that have wanted to turn that decision around for a very long time, and now they have their poster board to do it.
All right. Thank you, Mary. There's another issue that Chris Sununu touched on in this morning's interview that is one that a lot of Republicans have talked about and, certainly hope to get some progress with a Republican in the corner office, and that is tightening New Hampshire's election laws. Why don't we take a listen to what Governor-elect Sununu said on that front this morning?
Well, I've never been a big fan of same-day voter registration. Most states don't have it. There's a reason, right? Because it can cause problems. There's
no doubt
about that.
Would you support a bill to do away with it?
With same-day voter registration? Yes, I would. I would. Look, we have the first-in-the-nation primary. That is a great responsibility. We just need our laws tighter. It's not about fraud and a rigged system and all that kind of nonsense. It's really about just making sure that our rules are clear, that they're unambiguous, and that people can believe that as a full-time resident of the state of New Hampshire, your vote isn't being, watered down by someone who's kind of – drive-through voting or drive-by voting or whatever it is.
All right. That was Chris Sununu this morning on NHPR's Morning Edition. Now, Trent, he said that he hopes to tighten laws, get rid of same-day registration with the mind of making sure that full-time residents of the state of New Hampshire's votes aren't diluted. Translate what you think that means.
Let's be really, really clear about what this would have meant in this election. It would have meant that Donald Trump would have won New Hampshire. It would have meant that Kelly Ayotte would have stayed in the Senate. And that's why Republicans are very concerned about this. If you look at same-day registration numbers in places like Durham, places like Hanover, places like Keene, what do they have in common? College students. And so Republicans are very concerned because the margins in Durham, for example, they had historic numbers of people voting. There are about 14,000 people who live in Durham. 10,000 of them voted. The vast majority were people who registered that day. That town went 70-75% to Democrats. So what Republicans are looking to do is curb that to make sure that there's no same-day registration. So that, if you're a UNH student, for example, and you had not previously registered to vote, you cannot go to the polls on Election Day and vote. Another thing that Republicans, and I don't know where Sununu stands on this, but something that I've heard the chatter around the state house is they're also looking to change the definition of being a New Hampshire voter. So currently, the law says that you need to be domiciled here. And there's really no great explanation of what that means. So there are people who can show up for a day and then vote. What Republicans are looking – some Republicans in the legislature are looking to do is change that. So you need to be a resident here. So you need to have a driver's license here. You need to pay taxes here.
All right. Stick with us. More on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup in just a minute on NHPR. The weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or @NHPRExchange on Facebook and Twitter. And before the break, we were wrapping up discussing potential changes to election law supported by Governor-elect Chris Sununu, and that some Republicans in Concord have certainly been chomping at the bit for some time to make some of these changes. And, Trent, you brought up the margin in Durham. And, just to put that into more precisely, Governor Hassan carried Durham by 3,000 votes over Kelly Ayotte. The final margin in that race was 1,000. And so, you know, targeting student voters and wanting to make sure that ones who you know, in their estimation are truly from New Hampshire is something that Republicans have been done for a long time. But, you know, constitutionally, you know, election laws can get, you know, fraught. You know, Dean, do you think that this is just going to that this will happen with a Republican?
I think there will probably be some attempts for it to happen. And
I mean, same-day voter registration is certainly something that we have because we don't have motor voter.
Whatever ends up moving through the state legislature and assuming that Chris Sununu signs it, you know, it will probably end up in the court. Someone will challenge if it's a changing the, you know, we've had court cases before about the meaning of domicile and whether or not you can, you know, have certain additional requirements for people to vote. You know, the interesting thing about that clip we played before the break was, you know, what he seemed to be suggesting is, well, it's not really about fraud, but, you know, if you're going to vote, you need to sort of be sufficiently committed from a civic perspective that you are willing to kind of register in advance and vote in the primary and sort of be part of the civic life. And I understand that conceptually, but from a constitutional perspective, you know, people should be able to vote. So this has been, I mean, this debate, I remember when I was in college, you know, 35 years ago about student, you know, university towns and college towns and the issue of access to the polls. And so it's a perennial issue.
And you bring up a great point about lawsuits. And I think that I've heard from Democrats who say
that
is what, you know, look, they don't have control of the House, the Senate or the governor or the corner office, but they will be able to file lawsuits that will prevent legislation from going into play for 2 years and hope that something changes in the next election.
All right, let's go to the phone. Zib is on the line from Concord. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm a supervisor of the checklist in my ward in Concord, and I've been doing that for maybe a dozen years or so. And I guess, first of all, I'd like to say I can't understand why any candidate or any person in office would want to restrict access to the polls. I mean, it is the most fundamental thing we can be doing in democracy. So for Chris Sununu to say he's not sure, you know, he supports the idea of, you know, voting ahead or registering the same day just smacks me of being kind of anti-democracy.
All right.
But the other point is I don't entirely agree with what your pundits are saying about it being a way to reduce Democratic involvement. I certainly saw lots of working class folks coming in the door to register. And of course, I don't know how they voted, but they felt they could exercise their franchise. And they did.
And all right. Thank you.
Just an interesting sort of tidbit. I was just checking out some polling places in Nashua on Election Day. And there was a crew there from New York, a TV crew. And we were kind of joking around about domicile. And one of the camera guys who had flown up from New York stayed at the Radisson in Nashua the night before. And he said, well, I stayed at the Radisson the night before. I am currently domiciled in New Hampshire. And so I can go in this polling place and vote. Now, I don't know if he did that. I mean, I don't know whether that's actually legal or what all the details are. But I think that's the concern that Republicans have, is that people come up from New York, Massachusetts or somewhere, stay in New Hampshire working for a campaign for a few weeks, a few months, and they're just trying to figure out, are you a resident of New Hampshire? Should you have the right to vote?
Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. We'll stay with you know, we're talking somebody explicitly about young people and voting, and we'll stay with UNH for a minute. There was a story that was in your paper, Trent, this morning, sort of fallout from last week's election, specifically political activity at UNH from faculty and on an official UNH Facebook page from the Women's Studies program at UNH. You know, what's going on there?
It's an interesting story. So the UNH Women's Studies Facebook page. This is an official site. They were posting, come to the Women's Studies Department and we'll help you prepare signs. We have all the materials. We will give you these school resources to create signs and anti-Trump protest material. There's a state law that prevents any sort of group like that from using taxpayer money for lobbying or political purposes. And so UNH actually said, you know, these posts were a mistake. We are going to take them down. It looks like only a few of them came down. But there was some controversy from people on campus who said, hey, you know, I don't think this is fair that an official program at UNH is, you know, protesting the president-elect, is supporting one candidate over another one. And so we'll see if they actually take the Facebook post down.
Another wrinkle in this story was involving the Carsey Center director, Michael Ettinger. These were emails that came out some time ago in the WikiLeaks where he was in direct contact with Clinton campaign manager John Podesta, among other things, asking, how can I be helpful from my perch here in New Hampshire? You know, that's gotten some flack, but, you know, he has said that they reached out to Republicans as well. He had a relationship with John Podesta. But, you know, more broadly, Ella, do you think that this will sort of reignite, you know, sort of essentially Republican scrutiny of UNH in terms of budgetary matters, political activity, just, you know, add to friction that's been ongoing for some time?
I mean, it could in the legislature. I don't know if it necessarily will from Sununu's perspective. In terms of education funding, he's said that he is open to upping the levels of state support to the university system. And so I don't necessarily know that these you know, new leaked emails or postings will change people's minds. But you know, certainly you know, in the 2010 Bill O'Brien legislature, I remember being I was actually a UNH student at that time. I remember, you know, hearing about attempts to, you know, kind of do away with some same-day registration and voting, and a lot of students feeling very indignant that their right to vote was being quashed. So I guess we'll see.
All right, let's go to the phones. Andrew's on the line from Keene. He wants to talk about domicile changes. Good morning, Andrew.
Hi. I wanted to add to what you guys were saying earlier about messing with the sensibilities to vote by changing the laws. It wouldn't just affect anybody who's a student. It would affect anybody who cannot physically get to a polling place, such as somebody who might be serving overseas in the military, somebody who has a physical disability and might not want them to leave the home, things of that nature. So it's really going to disenfranchise a lot of people if he can get away with the changes that you guys were talking about.
All right, Andrew. I'm not sure he's talking about getting rid of absentee balloting, which I think would be more germane to those concerns. But it is interesting the degree to which, you know, even any sort of commentary on sort of changing a voter law kicks up a lot of strong feelings on both sides. You know, again, to be clear, you know, what Chris Sununu proposed was he'd, you know, consider getting rid of same-day registration and you know, it's 6 weeks till he takes office and then the legislative process. So we will see. But, you know, some key players in that debate are certainly going to be members of the New Hampshire House. You know, the House is retained Republican control. Interestingly, it's the first time that the Republicans have kept their majority there in consecutive terms since 2004, which is remarkable given the historic kind of hegemony the GOP had enjoyed there. But one thing that's interesting is that House Speaker Sean Jasper is facing challenges to his leadership, isn't he, Dean?
Yeah, he's faced at least three people are challenging him. And the issue here was that, you know, when he won the speakership, you know, there had been an initial candidate coming out of the Republican caucus, and then he was able to actually win the speakership with the help of Democrats. And so he's being challenged, Lori Sanborn of Bedford, Carol McGuire of Epsom, and I believe Frank Separato of Derry, right. Yeah. So, and just, you know, the general tenor there is to A, kind of respect the will of the caucus, and B, push for essentially more conservative leadership. If you remember back to when this all went down with Jasper, there was going, you know, the issue was going to be, would there be you know, real divisions in the Republican caucus in the House, and so that kind of played out, and then we didn't hear that much about it, but we kind of knew that assuming Republicans kept control of the House, there would be some challenges to Speaker Jasper, and that's basically what we're seeing.
Well, I mean, it is interesting in that, you know, this time all the candidates say they will abide by the will of the caucus, and had that been the case 2 years ago, it would have been Speaker Bill O'Brien,
right.
And the only reason Jasper was able to be Speaker was that he threw in his lot with Democrats who supported him because they were fearful of Bill O'Brien returning as Speaker. And, you know, Democrats have chosen Steve Shurtleff as their leader in the House, and he says that they're not going to be throwing in their lot. So whoever wins the Republican caucus vote will be Speaker, which is traditional trend.
Well, that's what we thought, too, when Bill O'Brien was going to be Speaker. And I remember both the Union Leader and the Concord Monitor had big headlines in their Sunday paper saying, meet the new Speaker. And then that didn't turn out. So to me, this is the most interesting thing that's happening in New Hampshire politics in the next few weeks. The vote is on the 30th. And I think what we're going to see here is whether or not Republicans are able to keep it together, work together, and get stuff done, or whether they're going to have a very fractured party. And I think if we see them having a fractured party, you know, I think if we see Sanborn and Saporito voters kind of splitting the vote and then not accepting whoever the winner may be, I think that it's going to be a bad sign for Republicans and the Sununu administration in terms of being able to actually get stuff done.
Well, is it a sign of confidence or a recognition that trying to work with Democrats to retain the speakership? Because, you know, the upper presumption around the State House among a lot of people was that, you know, if Jasper really wanted things to happen for him in policy, in a policy level, or in terms of making sure he keeps his leadership, would be to essentially do what he did 2 years ago. And just the fact that we're going to have a straight up vote with four people is his logic. You know, the vote will be divided. You know, I led the House in a way that, you know, I believe the majority of Republicans will support me. You know, Dean, what do you think?
You know, we'll see. I think, you know, what Trent just laid out here with the potential for a divisive House, that was a very similar conversation to what we heard the last time around with Speaker Jasper. And remember Bill O'Brien, they set up shop kind of separately on Main Street to kind of have this conservative caucus. Not a lot materialized from that. You know, so we'll see what comes out of it. I certainly know, you know, someone like Lori Sanborn, she's been talking about running for a while now. And so, you know, she'll certainly be in the mix, but we'll see.
All right. Let's go to the phones. Sherry is on the line from Nashua. Good morning, Sherry. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to weigh in on the same-day voter registration. I don't think it's a great idea that people are allowed to register to vote on the same day. I have heard, I don't know this person personally, but I've heard of somebody who actually voted for Obama six times in one day. The same person went just to different voting stations and voted for, I mean...
But so you haven't personally witnessed anything that you believe, you know, would compromise the integrity of the elections?
No, this was something just a...
And are you a Republican?
I am undeclared, but I backtracked in my mind, and I don't think I've ever voted democratically.
All right, Sherry, thank you. Thank you for calling. All right.
Yeah, it's interesting that she raised a number of issues in my mind. The first thing is this issue of independence. You know, we have the undeclared voters in this state, I think, are over 40% of the – it's about 43%. You know, of that, 40-some-odd percent of people who say they're independent, you know, most political science research shows that the actual number of true independents who don't consistently lean one way, as she just suggested she actually does, is much smaller, 10 to 15%. And those folks tend to be less engaged in politics and not regular voters. You know, it's interesting. You know, the caller said that she had heard that this person voted six times, and you know, this is essentially what you hear from Republicans who are who talk about voter fraud is that they're, you know, these sort of anecdotal stories and even these occasional videos that we've dealt with over the years. But there's just not any systematic evidence of this yet. When you talk, it's interesting. I can't tell you how many times I've heard from Trump voters, literally first person, where you know, I've mentioned to them, you know, Hillary Clinton's going to win the popular vote by over a million votes, and they say, well, that's the, you know, people who are here illegally and vote fraud and, you know, dead people voting. I mean, in the mind of part of the electorate, this is a real problem. In the mind of a different part of the electorate, it's just kind of you know, fictional, that there's no evidence. And I don't know how you resolve this, but we hear these stories every 2 years, and there's just not a lot of systematic evidence that's happening in big numbers.
All right, we have Martha on the line now from Durham. Good morning, Martha. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My concern is, how does he reconcile the fact that he doesn't want same-day voting, which, having worked the polls, these people have been in town, have local addresses that can be checked, and we do check those things. And how does he reconcile that with the fact that all the voting restrictions and reduction of polls and the difficulties that many minority groups found this year, that they couldn't get to the polls, that they were pushed out, that they were challenged more than anyone else, and mostly took place in Republican states?
So I'm concerned about how he thinks this is not as reprehensible as that was.
All right, Martha, thanks for the call. Obviously, a lot of strong feelings on this one. And why don't we take one more call on this? And I believe we have Barbara on the line from Chesterfield. Barbara, good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm the town clerk in Chesterfield, and I want to push back on the Radisson comment. Nobody could come in and register to vote by bringing in a receipt from a hotel. There's actually a lot that people need in order to register to vote, even at the polls. They have to prove that they live. They have to bring bills in, you know, like utility bills, or they have to have a driver's license or a pay stub that shows where they, you know, with their address on it. It isn't as though you can just walk in and say, I live here.
Can't you just sign an affidavit saying that you live here?
You can, but if you check with town, I spoke with some other town clerks in our area who said there were maybe a handful of people. We had two people in Chesterfield with 172, I believe, new voters registering. We had two who did affidavits. Swansea, which is three times bigger than us, had a handful of people who signed affidavits. You know, and all of us actually know that as many people who were much older, they're not students, were coming in and registering to vote. You know, it isn't, this is just one of those stories that goes around to make people distrust the system.
All
but
right.
We're pretty.
You're running
a tight ship
in Chesterfield, I hope, Barbara?
Well, I think everybody is in the state. I can't imagine. We all have the same laws we have to follow.
All right. Well, thank you for calling, and thank you for your service as a town clerk.
And just to be clear, the law, you do not, if you want to register same day, you do not need to show a license. You do not need to have bills. You can absolutely go in there with none of that, and you can sign an affidavit. And I understand it's not a big issue in Chesterfield or in Swansea, but we're talking about Nashua here. We're talking about Manchester. We're talking about Durham. These are big towns with lots of people. And so that's what Republicans are very concerned about.
But just to be clear, that's a separate issue from, I believe it was Sherry who was talking about hearing that somebody voted six times. I mean, this is an issue of, you know, people voting who are really primarily residents of the state. That's been the debate, and
yes,
that's a little bit different than kind of the fraud issue.
And if this guy voted six times for Obama, that is a very serious crime. And the Attorney General's office actually investigates these claims. And we
sure
do stories after every single election. The AG's office sends out investigators. They try and find people who voted twice in the same election, which I think may be a felony. And they actually prosecute these people, and we run their mugshots in the paper.
All right. Stick with us. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. Be right back after a break. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, do join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or @NHPRExchange on Facebook and Twitter. This week, we have Ellen Nilsen of the Concord Monitor, Trent Spinner of the New Hampshire Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University. You know, we've been focused so much on the implications of the elections at the state level that, we're one of the few people who've lost sight, at least temporarily, that there was a big national election and that the implications of Donald Trump being president are something that's definitely on voters' minds. And, you know, one area in which it's particularly on people's minds was the implications for Obamacare, so-called Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. Ellie, you wrote about this week.
Yes.
You know, people are concerned. What should they know?
Well, you should know that nothing is going to change, at least immediately. So the way that the system is set up, your policies have gone into effect for the year 2017. So they'll be in effect until 2018. But after that, it's kind of unclear what is going to happen. There's been sort of a lot of chatter from people about what Trump is going to do to the Affordable Care Act. A lot of stuff from Trump. he obviously has said repeal and replace multiple times on the campaign trail and continued to say so. But in the last week has signaled that he would be open to keeping some of the more popular provisions of the law, including allowing children to stay on their parents' health insurance until they're 26 years old. Certainly things about expanded Medicaid. He's talked about, rather than the current system, about giving states federal block grants and sort of giving them more leeway to use that money as they see fit. That could change in New Hampshire. Right now, the state and the federal government are kind of going back and forth over the state's proposed work requirements for expanded Medicaid, which would mean that I believe that you would either have to be employed or looking for a job to benefit from the program.
I mean, that's certainly something people are going to be watching to see where Governor Alex Sununu ends up heading on that front. You know, he said that what he hopes to do is use New Hampshire's leverage as, you know, sort of remaining kind of on the fence about the program to extract a program that is most beneficial to people here. And, you know, Dean Ella mentioned the ways in which President-elect Trump has said, well, maybe we can keep the parts of Obamacare that are popular, pre-existing conditions, stay on your parents' plan until you're 26, which is actually current law in New Hampshire. It was the law here before it was federally. You know, hard to know how to make the whole law work if you only keep the good parts.
Right. That's the issue. And, you know, it's going to have it has a significant impact on cost and the ability to offer insurance on these exchanges at an affordable rate. You know, the battle cry of most virtually all Republican candidates over the last couple of years for president during the primary certainly was, you know, day one, I, candidate X, will repeal Obamacare, repeal and replace, or certainly repeal. You know, the reality is a lot more complicated. The president can't unilaterally repeal a piece of congressional legislation. That's got to go through Congress, even with a Republican control of both houses. Having Trump kind of back away a little bit, at least on the pre-existing conditions and on the insurance coverage on family plans, it's going to make things even more complicated. I've seen a number of stories in the national press in recent days that suggest that this could be a lot more of a drawn-out process. And, you know, Trump further complicated things by saying that he would not do away with Obamacare until there's something else already in place so that people can immediately switch on to some other form of coverage. You know, and here in the New Hampshire, we've got almost 50,000 people who get insurance on these exchanges, and there's overlap, but about 52,000 people on expanded Medicaid. So there are real populations at risk here. And, you know, Trump has, you know, he's kind of creating these sort of additional conditions that I think will make repeal more complicated and then, you know, have an impact on the ability to have a viable insurance pool in order to be able to offer affordable rates on the exchanges.
Well, a lot of what's going to happen in Washington is going to depend on the president-elect's capacity to work in concert with Republican leaders in Congress.
Sure.
You know, obviously right now New Hampshire has an all Democratic delegation, and how Democrats choose to interact with Trump is also interesting to watch. I mean, so far there's been a lot of, you know, we ought to, you know, keep our minds open about potential good things beneficial to New Hampshire, but, you know, resist when it's appropriate. Why don't we hear from what New Hampshire Senior Senator Jeanne Shaheen said this week, talking to All Things Considered host Peter Biello on New Hampshire Public Radio, in respect to something that was a flashpoint in the last election, which is judicial nominees. Why don't we listen to Senator Shaheen?
I believe we need to move forward. As I said, throughout the last year, as the Republicans in the Senate have blocked consideration of Merrick Garland, that the Senate has a responsibility to advise and consent when a nominee is sent over from the president for the Supreme Court. We have a responsibility to hold a hearing on that nominee and to take action up or down. So I believe we should do that when a nominee is sent over, and it depends on who it is, how I will vote.
All right. That was New Hampshire Senior Senator Jeanne Shaheen saying that, you know, when President Trump brings forward his nominee to replace the vacancy left by the death of Justice Scalia, that she's going to call for Democrats to hold hearings and vote. Trent?
Yeah, that's interesting. We'll see if that happens.
I mean, during the waning points of the campaign, there were some Republican senators who said that, you know, they would you know, look to block anybody that that Hillary Clinton nominated. And it'll be interesting to see who Donald Trump chooses to nominate and how
Yeah, and I mean, there's you raised a bigger issue of how Democrats will work with the Trump administration. You know, one of the first bills that is likely to come up is a big infrastructure bill. You know, Trump kind of building on his you know, background in construction and big projects, likes the idea of kind of getting America's roads and bridges into better shape. And so there may very be a huge infrastructure package. That's traditionally a way to bring a lot of taxpayer dollars back to the state. There are some Democrats who are actually, you know, some want to do that because it's a good thing to bring the money back to the states. But others believe that it would give, you know, Trump increased political capital. So there are real debates within the Democratic caucus and Congress about do you sort of cooperate when it kind of makes sense for your state, or should you simply be obstructionist as kind of payback for the way that Democrats Republicans were while President Obama has been in office. So we'll see. But this is a real debate. I hear some people say no. Some Democrats say we got to block everything. Other Democrats say pick and choose.
Well,
your
some
battles.
Democrats are also saying, like, hopefully, let's get some emergency funding for opioids.
Sure.
And that was certainly something that Donald Trump talked up a good deal dealing with the opioids as he campaigned in New Hampshire during the run up to the election. And obviously, there's a big Surgeon General's report out on opioids, Ella. You know, what's, you know, any fresh takeaways from that, or just kind of more grim news about how it's a bad problem and it's going to take a lot of work?
Well, I think it was more just sort of addressing the stigma. And it was kind of, you know, there have been a lot of reports out from the federal government, but this was kind of the Surgeon General weighing in and saying, you know, we believe that addiction is a disease. It's not a moral failing. It is, you know, when you use drugs and alcohol, it fundamentally changes your brain chemistry and makes you, you know, psychologically and physically dependent on these substances. The other interesting thing that they said was they talked about medically assisted treatment like Suboxone and methadone, which have kind of, I think Suboxone less so, kind of also suffered from stigma issues from users using them. And just to be clear, those are medically assisted treatments that are also opioids. So some people criticize them, saying that even though drug users can use them and sort of replacing one drug with another. So the Surgeon General's report came out very strongly against that notion.
Well, one thing that was interesting this week is that New Hampshire joined a lawsuit against the maker of Suboxone, 41 other states. Reckitt is a drug company, and this is about Reckitt's efforts to increase patent protections.
It was fascinating. The allegations in this lawsuit. So what the attorneys general of 41 states are arguing is that this drug company created a pill, and the pill was a very effective opioid. And then after their patent was going to run out in 7 years, what they did was they changed it from a pill to a strip, almost like a breath strip that you put on your tongue. And then they were able to use marketing and price differentiation to move people off the pills and onto the breath strips. And then when they had a critical mass on the breath strips, they patented that again. So they had another 7 years, and then they phased out the pill. Now, they only phased out the pill in the U.S. where these laws exist. Everywhere else in the world, they were still selling the pill. And the AGs are saying that they were making $1 billion a year by doing this.
That's obviously a lot of money. And this action on the state's part comes at a time when, you know, the state's exploration of legal action against narcotic painkill manufacturers for deceptive marketing is ongoing. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see where this goes. And in terms of, you know, how long this takes for a decision to be made, you know, I'm not entirely sure where – I mean, it's the AG's call. I'm not entirely sure where Governor-elect Sununu is on all of this, and you know, how long this will take, and might this end up under the purview of whomever he ends up appointing to be attorney general? And obviously, there's been speculation as to who that could be.
We are hearing that it is likely to be Gordon McDonald, who has a lot of experience working on medical claims and medical cases with hospitals. He is an attorney at Nixon Peabody, and he, if you may remember him, he was co-counsel for a group of 300 medical providers who, when Governor Lynch wanted to move about $100 million out of the medical malpractice fund, he sued. He created a class action lawsuit and won that. And so these medical providers got that money back into their insurance fund. So he's pretty well versed in the medical industry in New Hampshire.
I mean, there are other names out there, and you know, we'll see who Governor-elect Sununu ends up picking. In the meantime, Attorney General Foster is looking at the deceptive marketing. Tell us what you think about the opioid crisis. I think we're done with same-day registration this morning, but any other topic we've discussed, the number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange at NHPR or NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. And you know, there's also been a lot of scrutiny and speculation regarding you know, the future of Kelly Ayotte. Obviously, it was a very narrow defeat. You know, 1,000 votes gone the other way. We, you know, would be talking about, you know, she, you know, took a tough stance on Trump, survived running in a presidential year, which tends to favor Democrats. Instead, people are wondering, well, what's next for her? Obviously, she's somebody who's young, who, you know, could have a future in politics, could certainly have a future in the business world. You know, she's kind of cooling her powder at the moment, Dean. Yeah. You know, lots of options for her, though, presumably.
Yeah, you typically expect candidates after an election like she just had talk about reconnecting with her family, and that's essentially what she's saying. I don't think she's going to have any shortage of opportunities in terms of what she wants to do next. She's someone who, you know, sort of very quickly over 6 years built up a lot of political capital in D.C. among Republicans, some fair degree of expertise on defense and military issues. You know, she's been kind of bandied about a little bit as a potential Trump appointee. You know, so far, the appointments that Trump has made so far really kind of reflect his core group of supporters. She obviously was not one of them, but at some point in an effort to kind of extend out.
We'll see. Like, I mean, yeah. I'm certainly willing to be. I mean, I've certainly been surprised by Donald Trump before and will likely be again.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's sort of, you know, there's kind of these concentric circles, yeah. The inner circle, well, which are his closest advisors.
I mean, you look at who advisors. Is sort of pushing this notion, yeah. of Ayotte, yeah. as a cabinet person, like George, right. Will, Jennifer, right. Rubin.
Well, the theory is that's how he could extend an olive branch to establishment Republicans, much in the same way there's all this speculation now about Mitt Romney potentially being Secretary of State. Who knows if that will actually happen?
Hard to see that one ending well, sure, for Romney, sure, but right. whatever.
Certainly hard to see, but that's part of the speculation. But, you know, in any event, I think she's going to have plenty of opportunities to I mean, either go private or stay public.
I mean, it is interesting because, yeah. obviously she's young and she could certainly return to elective office. But, I mean, in some ways it's sort of akin to – you know, you work as a reporter, you know, you take a PR job and you might not be back, you know, as a reporter. You are a former U.S. senator, you know, take too many kind of corporate jobs. You know, the transition back into elective office
gets more complicated
as we've seen this year with yeah. a number of candidates elsewhere. And so, you know, obviously she could go to academia. You know, she could just, you know, become a private practice lawyer. You know, she had always said that she supported term limits and had several times said that she only really wanted to serve 2 terms in Washington. I always took that as kind of wait and see.
Yeah, I think we are going to have to wait and see. I think part of this is also going to be whether or not Jeanne Shaheen runs again. So, you know, we should be looking that far ahead, 4 years ahead. There was a really – going back to Dean's point about cabinet positions, there was a really great quote. I think it's the quote of the week. This came from an ABC reporter who's camped out outside the transition team offices.
In the elevator bank where they're spending most of their time.
Exactly. This is from Candace Smith of ABC News, who got a leaked quote from Donald Trump. And the quote is, "Mr. Trump has zero interest in having her, Kelly Ayotte, in the cabinet or anywhere else." I mean, that is such a Trump quote. And so I don't think that George Will and all these other kind of conservative Republicans are going to get their olive branch that they're looking for in Kelly Ayotte.
Trump is legendary for holding grudges. And so this would be an example of where he sort of has a long enough memory and it hasn't been all that long.
That's absolutely right. So I think, you know, I think we have to look. You know, remember what Jeanne Shaheen did? She worked at the IOP in Harvard, yeah. for a few years after her first loss and then was able to come back. So I think Ayotte will be looking at all her options, including private practice. But I do not see her as a Secretary of Defense or ambassador to the United Nations. I laughed at that one when I
saw that. I didn't see that one. Yeah. But, you know, looking ahead, you know, we're on the cusp of Thanksgiving, and so I'm sure we're all looking ahead to that. But apart from that, you know, what are we all going to be focusing on? Ella, what's on your agenda in the near future?
Yeah, well, I'm interested in looking more into the Suboxone filing. Obviously, budget hearings are coming up, so I'm sure a lot of people will be focused on that as well.
Trent?
We have a great story coming up in the Sunday news. Local hospitals have what they call never events. These are things that are not supposed to happen in New Hampshire at all. But in 2015, there were 64 of them. And so we're going to have a story about them. I'm really looking forward to reading it.
And Dean, what are you going to be keeping your eyes on?
Well, when I'm not studying campaigns and elections, now that the election's over, my other area is a bureaucratic decision making, presidential politics. I'm actually spending a lot of time looking at the kind of the transition and what's going to be happening in January. But I am interested to sort of slowly shift attention as well to what's going to be happening with the state legislature coming up in the winter. But that's still still a little ways off.
Yeah, certainly the speaker's race is going to be interesting in the near term, and after that, many, many bills, many, many hearings, lots of laws and sausage to be made at the Capitol in Concord, and a break from big-time elections for some time. So happy Thanksgiving, all. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.